The Tor code was invented by Alexei Kitaev way back long time ago, before most of you were born, probably, you know, late 1990s. I mean, I don't know the order in his mind, but the paper that that he wrote about this used the Tor code as an introduction, as I'm doing it, to more complicated topological codes. So the topological stuff that I'm showing you is not exactly what he had in his paper. It's stuff that had been developed, you know, another region of physics and or mathematics, but has since kind of come to dominate the idea of topological fault tolerance, which I haven't really explained yet, but I will probably in the rest of this lecture. At the end, at least get to tell you what the basic idea is, and then next time we'll talk a little more about the specific model. Okay, so we have this Q-dit torque code. Well, maybe before I do that, I should see if there are any questions on the first half. Yeah?
So if you have a torque code that's a little rectangular, like it's thicker on one side and smaller on the other side, is it known how to do photon gates on it? Like the Hellermann will not be anymore?
Well, I think it doesn't present a particular problem. I mean, when you need ancillas, you can, so if you need like a Hadamard ancilla, you can create it using the flipped orientation. Use one that has the other dimension thick and thin. You get a different code. And the point is that when you do the Hadamard, you get back to the right code. So you have to figure out ahead of time whether you're going to need an ancilla on the Hadamard basis or the original basis and create the appropriate one. And then once you have the ancilla, I think you can basically do everything. Other questions? Okay. So now let's think about the kind of continuum limit of this torque code again. Again, if you have errors, they correspond to pairs of defects. But there's a couple of differences. So first of all, we have a lot more kinds of defects, right? There's, before we had, well, I said two kinds, but really there's three kinds, right? There's X, Y, and Z errors. An X error corresponds to two plaquettes that are, two stars that are bad. A Z error corresponds to two plaquettes that are bad, adjacent ones. And a Y error has kind of one of each kind, right? It has a pair of stars and a pair of plaquettes, which are right next to each other. Yeah.
Which could later drift independently. So, I mean, it's not.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so if you consider, it depends what the model of errors is that causes them to drift, right? If X errors and Z errors are occurring independently, then the X type and the Z type drift independently. If Y errors are also occurring, then sometimes, you know, when an X error drifts, it'll drift but also create a pair of Z errors, right? That's what a Y error will do. So it's not so, but let's think about X errors and Z errors occurring independently, which is actually an easier model in this Q-dit case also. But in any case, so we have these basically two, again, there's two types of charges. X type and Z type. And I'm calling these charges, because in some sense they resemble electric charges and magnetic charges if we had magnetic monopoles. But another very important sense they don't, which is, of course, that electric charges feel an electric force between them. And these charges feel no force. Okay? But they do have this weird effect when you move them around each other, which I'll get to. So we have these X type and Z type charges. And they can have values either from 0, which is no charge, up to d minus 1. Bye-bye. Okay.
Why not use another quantum number?
conventionally, these types of things are called charges. And when it gets to the next part, it's still going to be called charge. Yes. Okay. Okay, but let's take what happens more carefully when you have an error that's causing one of these things. Okay, so suppose we have, a Z error here. Okay, so that causes two defects as before in the adjacent stabilizer generators. But what actually is the value of that defect? What charge does it have? Think about it. Make the error not yellow, so I can continue to use yellow to stabilize your generators. The error is going to be green. And so up here, we have what I wrote up there, x inverse xx. And down here, we also have it's not the best way to present it. Anyway, so also here we have x inverse x and x. Okay. But the important thing to remember is that we have x for this top quartet and x inverse for this bottom one. So what that means is that the charge of this top defect is going to be opposite from the charge of the bottom defect. So in particular, in this case, I believe. This is going to be -1, and this is going to be a +1. And by -1 and +1, I mean that you have eigenvalue. So these values here correspond to the stabilizer generator having an eigenvalue omega to the the Q, where Q is the charge. And omega, of course, is 2 pi I over D. Okay? So when we create these charges, they're created in kind of particle-antiparticle pairs. You have opposite signs. And of course, if this were z squared, then we have +2 and -2, and so on. And similarly for the x type errors. Okay. And now that we have value for charge, it's worth noting that that value is going to be conserved when we move these things around. So maybe this is a slightly better reason to call it charge, that it's, not all quantum numbers are going to be conserved when you move things around. This is, charge is not the only property, but it's one property that is. Okay? And why is that? Well, if you think about it, to move something, basically you're creating another particle-antiparticle pair. Right? So you have here -1 and +1, and if you move it down here, you can do that by creating another -1 and +1. And the -1 and +1 here cancel and you get 0. And so you move this +1 down here. And in order to move it down here, you have to create an antiparticle that matches. Right? So -- gives you +, so the charge is going to be the same. Okay? And so what happens, yeah?
This is modulo D, though, right?
This is modulo D. yeah, the conservation, I mean, it's meaningless if you add D. So conservation is conservation, modulo D or not. That doesn't really depend very much on the modulo.
So you can get enough particles to get a thing.
Right, okay. That's actually the next point. So what happens when you add particles that are different? Well, that, yeah, so maybe what you're saying is that minus 1 is the same as D minus 1, which is correct. Okay? So what happens if you combine particles? So if you pile two particles on the same, so you have two particles that are next to each other, and you move them together. Well, what happens, you get some particle configuration. And the combined particle, well, its charge is just the sum, modulo D, of the particles that you've moved together. Everyone see that? So we call this fusion particles. Okay. And so now the interesting thing. What happens if you move them? So again, if you move them, it's not path dependent, or at least not microscopically path dependent. Except, again, if you move one particle and loop around another. So of course, X type moving around X type doesn't do anything. Z type moving around Z type also doesn't do anything. But if you move an X type around a Z type, or a Z type around an X type, what's going to happen? Well, we can use the same basic argument as before, right? So it's maybe less obvious in this case. But moving around the path, again, is doing an element of the stabilizer. Okay? And we're interested in the eigenvalue of that element. That's going to tell us the overall phase that we get by doing this, which is just the charge of the defect. Well, it's omega to the charge of the defect. But there's a more complicated thing. If you have a higher charge, so that's the case we have a unit charge. If you have a higher charge, then the element of the stabilizer is a power of kind of one of these things that is just a product of x and x inverse. And so we get the appropriate power of the phase. So if we take a charge Q1 of one type, and if we move it in a loop, and suppose we have multiple charges inside the loop, well, again, their phases will add. So if you move in a loop containing total charge, again modulo D, Q2 of the other type, we get a phase which is equal to omega to the Q1, Q2. Or maybe the minus Q1, Q2. So one of them, it depends which one you're moving around and whether you're doing clockwise or counterclockwise. Maybe I need to explain that. So first of all, it's going to be different if you take an X charge and move it clockwise. Take an X charge and move it clockwise around the Z charge, or counterclockwise. So why is that? Well, one of them corresponds to a stabilizer, to some particular stabilizer element, and the other one corresponds to the inverse of that stabilizer element, right? Moving backwards is just the inverse operation. If z moves it forward, z inverse should move it backwards. So if we're doing the inverse operation, we have to get the inverse phase. And if you think about it, moving, let's see. So moving particle A clockwise around particle B is kind of the same as moving particle B counterclockwise around particle A. So let's see if I can draw that in a way that. It's obvious. So if you're particle A, you see B and you go around the circle, you see B is always on your right, kind of here in this picture, right? Okay. And if you're particle B, you see A on your left, and you go around the circle watching. Okay, he stays on your left. Okay? Which is the same as if particle B were to do this loop. Okay? So based on that extremely convincing argument, you can see that that this phase switches if you do the z type going around the x type versus the x type going around the z type, as well as orientation. So again, we get a global phase, but it's a much more interesting phase. Well, okay, slightly more interesting phase. Still a global phase, though, so it has really no meaning at all. I say that, but it's not completely true, right? If you could somehow do this phase conditioned on what some other qubit in somewhere out in the rest of your machine. So if this other qubit is zero, then you do nothing, and if this other qubit is one, then you go around the loop. Right, and that would be a phase shift on this other qubit. And in general, things like this you can see maybe in interference experiments, where you would somehow cause a particle to go on one of two different paths, which would either take it around the loop or not take it around the loop. But basically, you can't do very much with it. And in particular, if you do a really complicated thing where you move lots and lots of particles around, the total phase that you get will not depend on the order in which you do the loops in. Right? It'll only depend on the actual number of loops and what particles are taken around what other particles. Okay. So this is an example where, since the order doesn't matter, it's an abelian phase shift. And these are called So particles that have get these funny phases when you move them around each other are called anions. And since the order doesn't matter, these are abelian anions. Okay. But the next topic, if you want to do some interesting stuff this way, is to think about non-abelian anions. And when you start thinking about non-abelian anions, then you can start to do real computations just by moving particles around each other. Maybe that should be preserved for posterity. He said, awesome. Okay. There's going to be a lot of machinery to kind of describe a model where that happens. And actually, I'm not really going to describe the model. I'm just going to describe its properties. I'm not going to describe how to get it microscopically. Let's think more about this issue of moving one particle around another. So really, when we think about this as kind of a two-dimensional activity, right? Because if you think in three dimensions, moving one particle around each other, well, I said it was important whether it's a contractible loop or a non-contractible loop. But in three dimensions, all loops are contractible, right? Because why go through this point? Just go around it. Right? Everyone sees that, I see. OK. So it's a two-dimensional thing. So we have these particles we're moving around each other. But we're doing it in time. So what we could do is we could imagine a three-dimensional picture of the world lines of these particles. Okay, so they start out at some point. So we might as well say they're in a line. Well, since I only have a two-dimensional blackboard, I'm going to have to be a little limited in how I draw these things. But let's imagine it first, and then you'll be able to understand how the drawing is done. So they start out down here. So we have a bunch of particles in a line. And then we move one of them around another. And the other one stays here. Okay, so the world lines correspond to just strands. And these strands are getting mixed up with each other. Okay. So for instance, well, it's not really important that I have this particular braid, but let's do it. So in particular, so can you see that? Should I draw it bigger? So the important thing is there's these gaps here which you can interpret as one particle going in front of the other one. Okay. So here we have at t equals 0 three particles. And first what happens is we take the first two and we switch them in a clockwise way. Okay, so the one on the left goes behind the one on the right. And then we take what's now the second particle, but used to be the first one, and third particle, and we switch them in a counterclockwise way. So the one on the left goes in front of the one on the right. Well, if you're looking down at it. Yeah, OK. Yeah, I mean, there's a, yeah.
It's the other way.
It's all like this, and then
that's a
So I think the convention is to look down, but I could be wrong about that. It doesn't really all matter all that much, as long as you're consistent. Anyway, and so then we switch these two back again. So the one that started out in the first position is now in second position. The one that starts in third position stays in third position. The one in second position goes to the first position. Okay? So this is an example of a braid. Anyway, you can visualize this as a three-dimensional thing. So you'll notice that I've defined this in such a way that particles don't have to return to their initial position. So a braid is allowed to do that. But it does matter which one is going in front of the other ones. Okay. So it turns out that you can take two braids and multiply them to get a third braid. So how do you do that? Well, they have to deal with the same number of particles. You do that by doing one and then the other. So for instance, if we draw a line in here, so you see that this is a braid down here where we swap these first two particles and then the second and third one, or the other way. And then up here we do a second braid where we leave the first one alone and we swap the second and third one again. Okay? And so we put together these two braids to get this bigger braid that was the original one I wrote down. And you can easily see, I hope, that if you take any two braids acting on the same number of particles. You can put them together this way to get another bigger break.
Division is multiplying by the inverse.
Yes. So what's the inverse? That's confusing. So no, you can't go. You can't go backwards. This is time. So yeah. So what is the inverse of a braid? Has to unentangle them. So how does that work? Well, let's take a very simple braid. Let's think of this braid. What is the inverse of this braid?
Well, then if they went counterclockwise first, then go clockwise, or the other way.
Right. So we go the other way. So let's. The one on the left is going in front. So in the second part, the one on the left is going back. That's unambiguous. Okay. And if you look at this, you can see that there's one strand that's in front, and there's one strand that's in back. So it's not really a trivial braid. I mean, it is, but only because we're defining braids up to deformation. So so braids which can be deformed to each other and of course when I say that I mean while leaving the endpoints fixed. So if we can do that, then they're the same. Okay? And therefore it follows, and then using this rule that every braid, it turns out, has an inverse.
Yeah, it's just the time reversal, right?
It's the time reversal, and when you switch clockwise or counterclockwise. So, I mean, you might consider that a time reversal or not, but there's an ambiguity what you mean by time reversal. Let's put it that way.
I don't see it.
Well, so the point is that the chirality of this, so these two are inverses, and the chirality of this one is opposite the chirality of this one. However you define it, that's true. Right, because here the one on the left is in front, here the one on the right is in front. Okay, so time reversal means the location of the crossings gets reversed. But you also need to make sure that it switches the chirality, which is true if you're going to take the mirror image. But, it's not... it's a mirror image versus the rotation, right? If you think of this as a three-dimensional object. Okay. So anyway, so we have, we can take these braids, we can multiply them together. They have inverses. Is there identity braid? What's the identity braid look like? Just don't do anything, right? That's a braid, not a thread.
Another one,
okay. Prop 5. Now it looks like a pyramid, but not a pyramid, a pillar. The point is, let's see, so what else? So associative, is multiplication of braids associative? Yeah, Debbie.
Is it obvious that the inverse is unique?
Actually, as it happens, if you have all these other properties, if you have associativity in particular, inverses are going to be unique. That's a standard group theory thing.
But isn't that going to be sort of...
It's what's maybe less obvious, Well, you don't even need to. You don't even need to choose in that. But the left inverse and the right inverse are the same. You can see that, right? So it doesn't matter what's before or after. It still works as the inverse. And so inverses are going to be unique, which means that they can be deformed into each other. Of course, there's lots of ways of writing it down. But in fact, that's generally true of any group, that it's just if you have an inverse, it's going to be unique.
So when you define an action on the grid, do you just define it as the action per se, or with an action and a time of what it happened?
Well, so the order can matter.
Yeah.
Right? So for instance, this grade is not equal to, so this one you have one crossing one way and one crossing the other way. So if you do the other way around, these are different grades. So the order does matter.
Yeah.
But some things commute with each other, right? In that this grade is equal to I should really be better at finding these. I don't do this much. Is equal to this grade.
So those are always considered on the same footing, right?
Yeah. So this is covered under this condition. This is kind of a touchy-feely condition, but I'm gonna narrow down exactly what it means in a second. But first, I just want to make the simple observation that so this multiplication is associative. I asked that question, but never answered it. So the grades form a group, a braid group. Okay, and the braid group has generators, which are just the individual flips of pairs. So sigma I, we'll say, is the generator that swaps I and I plus 1 in the clockwise direction. This is I and I plus 1. OK? And so this equality tells us already something about the conditions on these braid generators. So one condition we know is that if this is I and I plus 1, and this is K and K plus 1, this tells us that sigma I and sigma K commute. But of course, it's only true when this is K is not I plus 1 itself, right? So this is true, in fact, when the absolute value of I minus K is at least 2. Okay. So this is one of the conditions on the generators of the braid group. Everyone understand that one?
Is it also true when I is
equal? Well, yeah, but that's kind of trivial. You don't really need to say that.
Well, yeah.
Because sigma I squared is clearly equal to sigma I squared.
Yeah, but...
So when I say the generators, I guess I should... we also have... This is a convention of group theory, that the generators you automatically get for free to sigma I inverses. And the conditions that I'm going to write down are only going to be the ones that are not automatic. Right, so it's like I'm not going to say that sigma I inverse is the identity, because that's the definition of the inverse. And you could imagine more complicated problems. Okay, but this is not enough to define the braid group. It turns out only one more class of conditions is needed. Are there questions on what we've done so far? Okay. So this other picture, so this is called the Yang-Baxter equation. Okay, so what does this say? It says, well, we do, first we do this one. So this is going to be j, j plus 1, j plus 2. So first we do sigma j, and then we swap the middle strand with the right strand. So that's j plus 2. And we're always, the one on the left is always going to the right, so we're using the sigmas, not the sigma inverses.
Now you have the middle one going on
top. This is j plus 1. J plus 1. Sigma j plus 2 would be this with the one on the k plus 3, which we don't want. And then up here we have the left again, so that's sigma j again. Okay? But if you look at this picture, you see, well, there's one strand in the front, and then this middle strand is in the middle, and this right strand is in the back. So really, we could kind of do them in any order. But that's not. Well, okay, so what happens is we're gonna put these things around a little bit until we get this. Okay, so in this one, you see, we do the one on the right first, the right two first. That's sigma j plus 1. Okay. J plus 2. And then we do the two on the left. That's sigma j. And then we do the two on the right again, sigma j plus 1. And you see, this is really the same, right? The one on the left is in front, and the one in the middle is in the middle, and the one in the back is in the back. And on the left, the j goes to j plus 2 goes to j, and j plus 1 goes to j plus 1, which is also true here. Okay? So these two pictures, you can see, can be deformed to each other. So this is really true. And it turns out that these conditions plus those conditions is enough to define the breaker. That's all you need to know about deformation, basically.
What do you mean, okay, the braid group is just like any possible braiding of anything? Is that what you call a braid group?
Yeah, so the braid group, well, yeah, so the braid group topologically, if you think of it as something with pieces of string, is the braid group on n strands. You take n strands, you do any kind of braid. You're fixing endpoints in the sense that the n strands start at particular locations and end at corresponding locations, but it could be that they switch locations, right? So that this one ends up over here, as I've given. You can do anything that doesn't go back in time, that doesn't physically touch each other in three dimensions. And we say that any two things that can be deformed into each other, again, without going through an illegal configuration, those are isomorphic. Those are equivalent. Those are the same, in fact.
Does it like include knots and stuff like that? Or
no, because to do a knot, you have to go back in time, basically. But you have things like these, which are really loops, right, where one goes all the way around the other.
Yeah. Right.
So there's a close connection between these things and knots, but we don't really need to deal with that.
Yeah, isn't the whole game about theory turning knots into braids?
Yeah, so maybe I can say just very briefly how that works. So it's not necessarily knots exactly. Well, knots or links. So what happens is if there's a couple of ways to do this, in fact. So if you, for instance, take all of these strands and wrap them around so that the, you know, connect, add, so you have some strand that's all knotted, that's all twisted, braided around each other. And you take some extra strand and connect the bottom here with the top here. And you do that for every location. Well, then you don't necessarily have one single piece, right? Then you have, it might be one piece that goes around in some complicated way. It might be a bunch of different pieces that are all tangled with each other. But what you get then could be knotted, it could be linked, it could be, well, linked is kind of the most general terminology, but it could do all sorts of complicated things that way. Okay? And in fact, anything that you can do with, and well, with, yeah. So anything you can do with string can be represented as such a braid for some number of strands, which might be a lot much larger than the actual number of pieces of string you have, right? Because it could go back and forth many times. Okay, but I just want to consider the braid because that's what we'll need for anions. Remember, again, these are the world lines of particles, so you can't knot the world lines of particles again without going back in time. Okay. Flatland meets the time machine. That would be interesting. Okay. Okay. So. So what eventually we want to do is, I mean, so I think we do solve this in the context of this, say, this qubit torque code. It's not very interesting because, well, we're taking a braid, but we don't care about the order. I mean, so things that are far apart don't commute with each other. I mean, commute with each other. So the order there doesn't matter. But here the order does matter, right? In that we change the order, we also have to change to j plus 1 rather than j. And when we start to move things around each other, well, in the case of the torque code, we couldn't get anything very interesting, just a global phase. But in general, if we have some non-abelian anion model, what we're going to want is some non-abelian representation of the braid group. Right? We want each of these switches we do to do something more interesting than a global phase. It's going to change the Hilbert space of our system. It's going to do a quantum gate on that Hilbert space. So the sigma i's, or sigma j's, are going to map to unitaries. On our qubits. Yeah?
Where's the name anion come from?
Well, so the suffix on is, of course, frequently used for particles. And in particular, anion is these anions also have kind of weird spins and weird charges, in fact, in the case where they're certainly known to occur physically. So in three dimensions, we have bosons and fermions, which have integer spin and half integer spin, and also have exchange statistics of plus one or minus one. So in two dimensions, you can have things that have fractional spin, that's not a half, and exchange statistics, which are also other roots of unity. And so I guess it's any on, as opposed to boson, fermion on. But these non-abelian anions, but those abelian anions that have these weird phases, those are just mundane, not sufficiently interesting for our purposes. So we're going to have to take something even stranger, really scratching the meaning of the word any, I guess.
When you're saying it's in 2D, so basically anion is not really physical, right?
It's always... Oh, no, these are very physical. They're like two-dimensional systems, like...
In approximation.
Well, in approximation, but that's good enough, in fact, in this case. And So you can get this kind of behavior in three dimensions too if you, so there's a lot of ways you can achieve a two-dimensional thing, right? So one of them would be to have just like strings in three dimensions and move the strings around each other. Then you can have more complicated braids, of course, where they're actually, you know, braids in the three-dimensional space. But in fact, a sufficiently flat system or a system that's on the boundary between, you know, the surface of something can still behave like, to a very good degree of approximation, like a two-dimensional system. And I mean, you know, if you listen to people in this building, the world's in the three dimensional view.
Oh, yeah. No
comment. Okay. So in order to do this, so we're going to need some kind of larger Hilbert space to work with. The problem is that when we had this torque code or the CUDA torque codes, we had a degenerate ground space. I mean, we had qubits that were encoded in this code, but moving anions around each other didn't touch that space, right? We could, if we moved an anion all the way around the torus, then we would change the encoded qubit, right, by doing a logical poly operation. But if you think of a very, very big torus, or a continuum limit, right, where kind of the spacing is very, very, very small. Moving all the way around the torus, that's a huge pain in the neck. That's too big. So what we really like to do is do something that we can just do by moving anions around each other. And so to achieve this, we're going to need to store data not in the ground space so much. Well, the ground state, kind of in the ground state of the system. But we're going to need basically, we're going to need a larger Hilbert space associated with the syndromes of these error correcting codes. And the charges are going to have a much more interesting spectrum, is not the right word, but they're going to have actual subspaces associated with certain charges or configurations of charges. And actually, that's a sticking point, one of the more confusing parts. Okay? And so we're going to have this more complicated Hilbert space that we're going to manipulate by braiding the anion. Okay. So in particular, if you think about this CUDIT torque code, we had kind of four basic types of things that you could imagine us doing physically. Again, if you look at the continuum limit. One thing we could do is we could actually create these anions, right, by causing an error deliberately. That would create a pair of anions which were in a charged, anti-charged state. So Q bar. So Q bar is going to represent the antiparticle, the one with the opposite charge. Okay, and when we generalize this, sometimes you'll be able to create a specific pair like this. Sometimes you won't get to choose. You'll be able to create a pair, but you won't get to choose what this charge Q is. It might be, or some kind of superposition of such things. And I think that will actually depend on details of the physical system. What you can do in that, which will be beyond what we'll get to in this course. So what else can we do? Well, in the, at least in the Q-tip torque code, and we'll continue to be true, we can move particles around. Right? But when we do that, we conserve charge. So what we're not allowed to do is change the charge. Even this, you'll notice, conserves charge, right? Because it takes a zero charge of no particles to something that has a charge and an anti-charge that cancel out. And since these are created locally, there's kind of local charge conservation. Okay? Well, what else can we do? Well, when we move them around, I mean, most of the time, we're interested in moving them around each other, but if we want, we can put them together. So we can fuse together anions. And finally, we can measure charges. So in the case of the Q-tip torque code, we could do that just by measuring the local stabilizer generator, right, to see if there's an anion in that location. We can also measure charge within a region in that case, right, whatever type of region we're willing to deal with, by measuring an appropriate stabilizer generator. That tells us the total charge of the appropriate type within that region. So in some more general physical systems, we might not be able to have quite that fine degree of control. And in fact, the main thing that we'll need is the ability to distinguish between some zero charge and some non-zero charge. Yeah.
Well, this braid, I assume you have to generalize the braid theory to handle things like making more characters to string?
So I guess you could generalize it by labeling these strands with, you know, the charge of the particle, or just labeling them with the actual name of the particle if you wanted to name the particles. I guess since these are anions, they're still indistinguishable in the sense of both of the fermions, so that's not a good thing to do. But yeah, they might definitely have different charge levels. I don't think that really makes a big difference in anything.
Depends more if you created a new pair of.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yes, you should do that. I think for the purposes of fault tolerance, we can just do that all at the beginning of the computation and not have to worry about it. Okay. So let's think about fault tolerance. So Kataya's motivation in thinking about a computation with anions was not just because it's cool, but although it's possible that was a motivation. Hard to really see inside Kataya's mind. But because such systems should display some kind of natural fault tolerance. Okay? In the sense that you wouldn't actually have to do anything. You just have to be, you know, moderately careful, but not super careful when you build these things and manipulate them. And the computation you do should be the correct computation. So why is that? Well, let's think about these various separate pieces and think about errors during them. Well, creating a pair of anions, I guess that could fail. But eventually, we're going to measure charge. So let's assume that always succeeds. But what's more serious if there's a thermal bath, and it causes an error that creates a pair of anions that we didn't intend. Okay, so what would be an error in this system? Well, for instance, if you had such a pair that you have a particle, so So for instance, if you have a particle that's part of your computer, and some pair jumped out of the bath, and so this is a particle one way and antiparticle the other way, and annihilated, went around your particle, one went one way, one went the other way, and then annihilated. Well, that's the same as having one particle do a loop around your particle, right? Which is going to do not just a fade, because it's not a Boolean ambience that we're going to get to. It's going to do some unitary operation on your qubit. Well, okay, qubit is a little more complicated, but it's going to do some unitary operation on your computer. And you want to avoid that, obviously. So that would be an error. But the thing is that we can avoid this. So, ooh, I didn't even erase this yet. So the thing is, the probability of that happening is related to the energy scale in this local Hamiltonian. I mean, we're not going to use this local Hamiltonian when we get to non-abelian anions, and I'm not going to write down an explicit one. But the point is, to excite an anion requires a certain amount of energy, right? Which is, in this case, it's the you could put a coefficient up here, and it would be that lambda. Okay? So what we need is the gap, the energy gap, between the ground state and the excited state. So the gap to create a pair of anions. Should be much larger than the temperature. Okay? And when that's true, then the probability of having a pair excited by thermally is something like e to the minus t over delta. Okay? And wait. Yeah, that's right. T over delta or delta over t. We want this to be very small. Delta over t. Need a better eraser. E to the minus delta over t. So the point is that when this ratio is large, this thing is very, very small. This is even only modestly large. This is very, very small. Okay? So the probability it's happening during the course of your computation is going to be negligible, assuming you can go to a reasonably low temperature. Okay? So what else can go wrong? Well, when we move the anions around, we might not do that right. Okay? But again, since it's topological in effect, it only cares which particles go around the other. The detailed path doesn't matter. But there's still something we have to do. We have to keep the particles far apart from each other, so that when we move, try to move one around each other, we don't accidentally, I mean, if there's a jiggle here, if they're far apart, that's okay. It'll still have a topologically equivalent path. But if we move it close to each other, then a jiggle might cause it to go the wrong way around. Okay, and then these last parts are not so sensitive. It turns out that in a lot of models, this fusion can be probabilistic anyway. So the way we're going to use it is that's going to kind of tell us how we can measure things, right? We're going to try to fuse things together, and if that works, and see what the charge is. And if we get zero charge or non-zero charge, that will be kind of the outcome of our computation. So we just have to repeat. To get a better accuracy. Okay, so the upshot is that everything that we're going to do in this computation is effectively topological in nature. In particular, when we move things around each other, that's a topological effect, just which one is going on around each other, because what grade we've done. Okay, so there are questions about this part? Yeah.
Sir, so I know you don't want to go into detail description of how you're going to make one of these, but some sort of vague hand-waving description, do we have one of those?
You mean the physical systems?
Yes.
Well, okay. So the main system that people talked about a billion axions is the quantum Hall system. So the idea is you have a flat system, right? A flat piece of stuff. So the Hall effect is this thing that you do to measure charge. So if you have magnetic field, to measure the sign of charge carrier. So if you have magnetic field and you have plus particles going one way, they get pushed this way. Plus particles going this way get pushed the same direction as minus particles going this way. But they create that means the charge that accumulates on the edge of this system is opposite. Okay. So if you do this experiment, you can find out what the sign of the charge carrier is in a given system, which incidentally is not always negative, right? I mean, we think of electrons being the charge carriers, but in a lot of condensed matter systems, the charge carriers are more complicated things, quasi particles that are a construct that combines other things, lots of different electrons. For instance, in a lot of semiconductors, you get holes or the charge carriers placed where there's an absence of an electron, so that's a plus charge. So anyway, so if you do these Hall effect experiments at very low temperatures, you see discrete jumps as the charge builds up, right? So that could be one electron at a time. So the charge should be, and if it's a hole, it could still be one hole at a time, right? We could still have a charge of plus E instead of minus E. But it turns out that in some systems, you can actually see fractional jumps. And that's because the charge carriers are actually composite things, these quasi-particles called anions. That we've been talking about. We haven't really been talking about them, but there are a billion amions that have fractional statistics. So they have, on their exchange, they get a phase that's some d-th-root of unity. And they have a commensurate fractional charge, which is kind of weird. But then there's even some weirder versions of this, where it's believed that there's not a billion amions in these systems. So people have been thinking about ways to approach those things and try to implement these topological fault tolerance. Unfortunately, the most common one, the one where it's most robust in some sense, in the sense of having a big gap, well, relatively big gap, and kind of best understood system, the anions there are not universal, so you can't get universal quantum computing. Not a billion, but still not enough. But there's another one that's more fragile that actually. So I'm not sure what the actual status is, but people think it's going to it displays this model that I'm going to talk about next time. It's still a quantum Hall effect. I believe it's the 15 halves, maybe 15 thirds. No, that would not be faster. I think it's 15 halves, not positive. The 5 halves one is the more robust one. It's most likely to be positive.
5 halves. Oh, right. Sorry. Yes.
Okay. So let me just say that a few more words about what we're going to do next time. So if you think about these requirements for fault tolerance, the information is, we're not really going to be able to store information in the individual particles that we're using, the individual atoms, right? Because the particles themselves are local things. So if you stored information in that particle, presumably there'd be some way locally that you could get it out again. Which in particular means that there's some way locally that the environment could mess it up. Whereas what's giving us our fault tolerance is by keeping these particles far apart. And by having a high gap, of course. And what that means is that we're actually going to need to store information not in individual particles, but kind of in the collective set of particles. So these are going to be non-local degrees of freedom. They're not attached to single particles. And in particular, the Hilbert space that we have is not going to be a tensor product of Hilbert spaces associated with the individual particles. It's not going to be a power of 2, even, the dimension of the Hilbert space, or power of anything, really. Well, power of some irrational number, maybe. No, not even that. As you add particles, it starts to approach an exponential, but it's not exactly. So this is going to mean the Hilbert space is kind of weird by the standards of things that we're used to thinking about in computing. But it still behaves some regular rules, which is what we're going to talk about next time. I don't think there's anything else I can do in the remaining 2 or 3 minutes. No, yeah. So, questions?
You said it was only believed that non-abelian anions existed.
Well, okay. So for one thing, it's hard to know exactly what a signature of such things are. So the fractional anions, I mean, they had a nice signature in terms of fractional charge, which is something that you can more easily measure. So in fact, it's by thinking about these quantum computing things that people have gotten the first good idea of how to test this experiment, to test this idea that there really are non-abelian anions. And the way to do that is to do some kind of interference experiment. That you take these anions, you try moving them, you know, one way or the other around the stationary defect. And, well, it should be something that's not just a phase shift going on there. It should be some more interesting kind of interference. And so there's people working on actually doing some version of that experiment, at least in the 5-PAS system.
Well, is the 5-PAS not universal, or is that?
Well, the short answer is, I don't know. The slightly longer answer is, I mean, so we're going to write down a bunch of properties, and then next time we're going to write down the basic properties that an anion model has to have. And basically what will happen at the end of the day, when you do these braids, so what's going to happen is we're going to have a unitary for each of these braid group generators, sigma sub j, right? And when you put them all together, they're going to generate some subgroup of the unitary group on this big Hilbert space. And if it's not a big enough subgroup, then you don't have universal computation. But I don't know precisely, offhand I don't know what exactly is the model that's relevant for the 5-PAS. Thanks. Anything else? Okay. And that's it for today.